When we begin to discuss the views of Pythagoras on the subject of poetry, we are a little bit reminded of the terse manner in which the late Calvin Coolidge often answered questions. We can say of Pythagoras, he was for it. And from this point on, we have to look elsewhere for further information. We know that the Pythagoreans made use of a number of so-called heterodox ideas in connection with therapy. We also realize that nearly all of the work of Pythagoras was highly specialized and highly scientific. He was perhaps the greatest researcher of antiquity. And in his school at Crotona, he carried on continuous efforts to solve human problems. He wrote extensively on the use of herbs, on various phenomena of color and of music. But unfortunately, his original writings are not known. Either they perished or remain like so many monuments of antiquity, awaiting discovery in some well-concealed place. We do know, however, through Porphyry, a little something of the Pythagorean concept of poetry. And we gain a trifle more from the studies of Aristotle, who apparently did have access through Plato to some of the fragments of the original Pythagorean learning. Out of Porphyry, for example, we find a fragment such as this, that ailments upon the right side of the body should be treated by odd meter, and that on the left, and those on the left by even meter. Now, this does not seem much, but it does tell us that it was more than a mere enjoyment of good reading by the sick, that there was a special purpose involved. Porphyry also goes on to tell us that Pythagoras was a strong believer in the development of rhythmic patterns in motion, in sound, in color, and in life generally. Thus we may understand Pythagorean aesthetics, particularly as these may apply to music, poetry, and the dance. Realizing that there might be something of interest in this department, and recognizing that the effect and influence of Pythagoras have been long experienced in society, it seemed advisable to make a brief survey of some early opinions concerning poetry, and even somewhat more recent attitudes and findings. It opens a very interesting and stimulating field. In the first place, poetry as an art is perhaps the closest by direct affinity to mysticism of any that we know. Even today, conservative critics of poetry refer to it in terms of absolute and relative vision. They explain that poetry represents a condition of consciousness not to be found in any other art that we know, but perhaps most nearly paralleled in music. What then would be the essential therapeutic difference between, we will say, poetry and music? The principal difference would lie in an element of rational or intellectual transmission. In music, we have the harmonic principle and the melodic line and the rhythmic pattern. But we do not have a direct transference of intellectual meaning. We do not have the musician usually conveying to us a particular and purposeful mood. Now, we may definitely feel that music does carry, and it does, a tremendous emotional surge. Music can cause us to feel. It can, to a measure, direct the condition or direction of feeling. It can give us a sense of exaltation. It can depress us. It can stimulate, pacify. It can produce a series of these moods. But with poetry, something else is added, and that is a particular and direct meaning, a meaning conveyed by words. This means, of course, that poetry is somewhat less universal than music, inasmuch as music will cut through the barriers of language. On the other hand, poetry is more intimate, more personal, and the creativity of poetry is more universal than the power of the average individual to compose or create music. The creation of music generally requires a highly specialized type of training, whereas the creation of poetry, some of the greatest poetry that we know, has resulted from comparatively little technical knowledge. It has arisen as a more direct expression of rhythm in consciousness itself. Thus, we have many persons comparatively without technical knowledge, even of poetry, who are able to create good poems, create them because of certain laws or principles resident in consciousness itself. Pythagoras, of course, differed from modern man in a number of his attitudes toward health. Whereas today, we throw particular therapy against particular ailments. The Pythagoreans were inclined to use a general therapy against a general ailment. The Pythagoreans were among the early psychologists to recognize that man's particular difficulties in life arise from general principles, from factors perhaps deeply submerged, but that the person is not sick because of one thing that he does, nor can he be caused to recover by the direct treatment of his immediate ailment only. We may be able to cure the ailment or treat it successfully, but curing the ailment does not mean curing the person. We may neutralize certain expressions of excess, whether these be psychological or physical. But we have a larger problem, and that is preventive medicine. We have the need of recognizing that health is a natural state, that the primary end of therapy is to preserve health, not to restore it. The fact that the individual is subject to innumerable ailments must bear witness to innumerable weaknesses in his own consciousness. To reach these weaknesses may and usually does imply a general restoration of his nature, not the mere correction of a particular difficulty. Thus, we do treat particulars when they arise, but only when they arise, and by that time, our essential problem of health has already passed into a problem of sickness. The prevention of the rise of particular difficulties requires the establishment of general principles. The individual must keep his health from the total psychological integration of himself. He may lose his health in any particular if this total integration is insufficient. Thus, Pythagoras, instead of thinking constantly on how to merely remedy certain ailments, recognize that there is a primary type of ailment. and that this ailment arises from psychic disturbance involving the total personality. The sick individual is telling us something beside the symptoms which we are able to immediately recognize. He is telling us that in various ways there are shortcomings in his general nature. These shortcomings do not provide the energy necessary for the restoration of the balance or equilibrium which would preserve health. Therefore, having at his disposal only an inadequate degree of self-integration, he proceeds to advance along the course of ailment until something of a definite nature appears, which is then treated according to its symptoms and not according to its cause. If, therefore, man is subject to innumerable vicissitudes of health and emotion, it is also true that he is troubled or burdened by innumerable restrictions or limitations within his own consciousness. And the work of the Pythagorean in healing was from the beginning the effort to establish a new relationship between the individual and his inner life, and through this inner life with the world around him. In this respect, almost all ancient peoples had recourse to certain arts. The origin of these arts we may never know, inasmuch as they originated in man's own unfolding need. We find that certain persons have been from the beginning peculiarly sensitive to types and orders of aesthetics, that primitive peoples not only have music and rhythm and the dance and song and mantram, but that these various aesthetic expressions become part of their entire social culture. Primitive society, as one anthropologist has noted, is actually founded squarely upon primitive ritual. And this primitive ritual is nearly always a ritual of song, dance, and rhythms. Now, why man should instinctively and inevitably come to this rhythmic approach to life can be explained perhaps best in terms of his own psychic organization. As Lao Tzu, the Chinese philosopher, pointed out, life is motion. Good life is good motion. Poor life is poor motion. Motion in which there is dissonance, discord, broken rhythms will be the poor kind of motion. Motion which moves, flows, and unfolds harmonically, rhythmically, melodically, gracefully. Such motion bespeaks health. Therefore, the cultivation of motion begins within the individual himself and requires a certain imposing of self-discipline upon motion. Motion is very closely interrelated with emotion. Emotion is a kind of motion. It is a qualitative motion within the soul itself. Therefore, emotion must also be rhythmic and harmonic, or else it will be dissonant. And all discordant actions of man arise from discord within man, and in turn impose discord upon society. Society, thus afflicted by the discords of the individual, becomes itself discordant and reacts upon the internal rhythm of each person making up the social order. Thus, both Pythagoras and Lao Tzu recognize the importance of the cultivation of motion, that this cultivation of movement, orderly, rhythmic, harmonic, had to do with the preservation of health. And if health is lost by one cause or another, the cultivation of rhythms helps to restore the harmony of the individual. When we come down to a more practical level of thinking, we must also divide humanity into a series of groups according to their reaction to rhythm or harmony. Some persons appear to be oblivious to harmony. Even a great intellectual like Dr. Samuel Johnson declared that poetry was nothing but prose jogging along like a trotting horse. He had no real understanding of it or appreciation for it. The same attitude has been present in a number of intellectuals. Even Plato, while he did not disparage the use of aesthetic arts, did not encourage them nearly as much as Pythagoras did. But Plato had a different type of mind. And in these different types of minds, we have explanations for different types of basic constitutions. I think we may follow the general Pythagorean theory and affirm that temperaments arise out of types of reaction to motion. The temperament is therefore the way in which we naturally receive or reject certain values in life around us. We have taken it for granted in our culture that man cannot accept everything, that the individual, by wholesale acceptance, may so diminish the intensity of his reaction that he is unable to intellectually circumscribe his field of activity. Therefore, he is scattered, broken, or shaken in his directives simply because he is unable to understand everything and do everything. On the other hand, there are persons who, by nature and instinct, are, we will say, poetic conscious. These persons may or may not actually write poetry. Or if they do, their poems may be of various degrees of merit. Yet there is a sensitivity in them toward this type of reaction. In the terms of absolute poetry, we must have that which comes the nearest to a full experience vision of internal rhythm or order. Relative poetry is that in which essentially the poetic mood is subservient to a transmissional form of some kind. Therefore, under relative poetry, we have that in which meaning dominates rhythm. We have the intellectual type of poetry. We have the propaganda. We have the military rhythms. We also have such things as anthems and things of that nature, in which actually we are using harmony or poetry as a means of transmitting a basic or fundamental idea. This idea, by the way, has a greater probability of being remembered or transmitted in poetic form than it has in prose form. The mind of man is curiously receptive to rhythms and is able to hold on to patterns that are rhythmed more easily than patterns lacking this quality. Also, we must admit that there is a considerable amount of poetry which is locked within prose structure. A great many prose works are actually of high poetic quality by the very use and selection of words and by the musical rhythms of the prose text itself. We find this, for example, as a common circumstance in many sacred writings, in which by virtue of the way in which they are versed and ordered, and by the sublimity of their language forms, they give us rather the impression of poetry than of prose. We also know, for example, that in our own Bible, many works that are now in magnificent prose were originally poetic. And to a measure, this poetic substance has survived in prose, as, for example, the Book of Psalms and sections of the Book of Job. In these points, we also note that the tendency of man has been to recognize poetry as nearer to sacred writing than prose in the majority of instances. The Greek oracles at Delphi and other places were nearly always revealed in the form of poetry, usually hexameter verse. Thus it came to the Greek consciousness that prose was the language of men and poetry was the language of the gods. When we analyze this more carefully, we are really saying that poetry is the language of man's spiritual internal. It is the language of the transmission of vision to mind. For in everything which man performs, the value or essential integrity must be clearly present. It would seem that the interior psychic life of man not only reveals great truths of consciousness, but also reveals them according to the very law of consciousness itself, which means that it reveals them harmonically. Inasmuch as consciousness by its own nature does not contain any breaks, any broken rhythms, or any crudities of presentation of its own context. Thus, in the study of poetry, we come to a series of facts about man's own inner life. Namely, first of all, that the spiritual factor in man, manifesting itself, does so in an orderly way. In other words, consciousness manifests not only its content, but its form. And its form is always harmonic, melodic, or rhythmic. On the other hand, the labors of man, arising from faulty or incomplete intellection, are distinguished nearly always by inconsistency, incompleteness, or the confusion of ill-digested material. Man lives in a world here in which the known and the unknown mingle in a confused mass, and out of this confusion must inevitably come a kind of reaction in which the content cannot follow smoothly. The person is subject to continuous interruption and the continuous changing of perspective. He is not able to maintain his own equilibrium. Therefore, to the degree that he descends into the material affairs of life, it was held by the ancients that he entered into a state of prose. We think of it perhaps at prose as being closely related to prosaic, and there is undoubtedly a psychic sympathy. The word poetry, coming from the Greek, simply means to make, to fashion, or to create. Therefore, the maker of a poem is a kind of creator. He fashions something. But the poetic consciousness with which he fashions is part of a universal consciousness in which rhythm and order are essentially inherent and therefore continuously present in manifestation. We have a wide range of poetic thought in relationship to Eastern philosophy and culture. And perhaps the greatest exponents of this in Asia are the Chinese, Koreans, and Japanese. In these groups, we find, for instance, the creation of the poem as a symbol of respect. We find that if a Chinese gentleman secures an admirable work of art, particularly a fine painting, which he regards with extreme respect and veneration, he will contemplate this painting. He will meditate upon it. He will search it as an experience of his own consciousness. he will try to unfold within himself the meaning of this picture to him. And when he feels that he has achieved this, he will write a poem. He will usually write a very brief poem and place it upon the margin of the painting in his own beautiful handwriting, which is itself an expression of almost uninterrupted rhythm. He will then seal it with his seal, and the poem and the picture will go on to future generations. Another owner may also experiment or react to this. His reaction may be different from the first owner. He will then add another poem. And in some of the very rare and early paintings, it becomes increasingly difficult to see the picture for the poems. But each of these poems has a distinct meaning of its own. It represents tribute. It represents the individual giving expression to his own interior feeling about a thing. And to many Orientals, this expression is as beautiful as the picture, inasmuch as it arises from the soul concept of the person. Therefore, we find frequently in Asiatic art that the picture is completely omitted from the scroll, and that the great poet simply prepares his poem, frames it as you would a picture, and hangs it on the wall. This poem becomes a kind of picture, inasmuch as it creates a mood. Thus we find in Asia particularly poetry and art interchanging, complementing each other, substituting for each other. In Asia also, where the contemplative life is somewhat stronger than it is in the West, poetry and literature become the great release media for the intellectual. In our Western world, we would not expect a scientist to be a poet. We feel that if he did write poetry, he would write something about relative states of gravity and so on, and we wouldn't find it particularly entertaining. But in the East, we expect the scientist to be a poet. We would regard him as an imperfect scientist. Unless he could come home from his laboratory or his school or wherever he may be, put on his simple home costume, go out and sit quietly in his bamboo grove and write a poem. If he could not do this, we would begin to wonder what kind of a scientist he was. We would say to ourselves, such men are dangerous. We would feel that this person, lacking interior imagination, lacking the power to touch or tap sources of beauty within himself, might be a rather brittle intellectual with whom we would have trouble one of these days. The same of the merchant. It would not be easy to assume today that someone under the stress of Western business would go home from a busy day at the office and dash off an ode or something like that. But this would happen in Asia. And while we have heavy pressures on us, Asia has also had many pressures with fewer resources to meet them than we have ever known. It is therefore part of culture, particularly pointed out by Lao Tzu and Confucius, that the intellectual, the practical man, the scientist, the philosopher, the warrior, all these should write poetry. Not only because it was a cultural requirement, but because it was a catharsis for a confused soul. It gave to the individual a peculiar ability to examine himself, to discover whether he had kept in touch with the deep springs and sources of his own consciousness. And if his consciousness becomes confused, if he is no longer able to divide consciousness from intellectual activity, if he is no longer able to divide his own internal life from his external profession, he is coming sick. He is becoming ill by degrees. And in time, this sickness will endanger his entire integration. The same concept, of course, moves through the Buddhistic philosophy of Zen. where the koan, or the brief poem of 17 syllables, becomes symbolic of a great many values in life. One of the important elements of most Oriental poetries, particularly Japanese and Chinese, is brevity. Brevity means essentially the power to go to the heart of a thing. The individual who is not certain, according to one Chinese scholar, writes a book. The one who is certain writes a poem. There is a certain poetry of certainty. If the individual cannot reveal his soul in 17 syllables, he cannot reveal it at all. We are not quite so certain that we can do that, but we do have certain evidences in our own way of life that brevity is not only the soul of wit, but the soul of transmission and the soul of revelation as far as the consciousness of the person is concerned. When we wish to make a truly profound observation, we may do so in 20 or 30,000 words, such as it is said was the case in the publication of a small handbook on the culturing of carrots by the government. It took really pages and pages and pages to take care of carrots. On the other side of the picture, we know that Abraham Lincoln wrote his entire speech for Gettysburg on the back of one envelope. The difference are in the totality of our understanding is expressed through the clarity with which we are able to express ourselves. Perhaps we have not recognized, for example, that essentially Lincoln's Gettysburg speech address is poetry. It is a magnificent kind of blank verse. Yet it is moved from within itself by such tremendous rhythms, such magnificent harmony, that we would be forced to recognize it as great poetry, regardless of who wrote it. Yet perhaps Lincoln would be the last person in the world to think that he was a poet. It was merely that a clear insight expressing itself in the fewest possible unnecessary words, and because of the direct impact of vision upon purpose, resulted in the speech taking the form of classic poetry. Thus, truth has a tendency to take poetic form wherever it is manifested to men. And in this, we have truth not merely as intellectual fact, but truth as vision, as link between the person and a field of consciousness. It is in this way I'm quite certain that Pythagoras approached his concept of poetic and music therapy. He recognized that if this work, and he is believed to have depended heavily upon the writings of Homer for his therapeutic poems. If this poem is pure rhythm vision, and it is read to a person of enharmonic maladjustment, that the tendency of this will be to cause relaxation, to cause the individual to experience a different kind of mood. This mood does not depend upon the words alone, though the words may play a part. It depends primarily upon the psychic recognition of the harmonic principle. This recognition is intuitive. The human being who lacks the ability to recognize rhythmic motion as inspiration or as a source of well-being should of himself begin to examine his own nature, because he is blocking his psychic life in some way. If he does not have a certain amount of music or poetry in his soul and is not able to call upon this at the proper time and under the proper circumstances, he cannot have the same interior strength that would be his had he a more aesthetic integration. We therefore divide the value of poetry from a therapeutic standpoint into two general classifications. One would be the therapy of creating or making poems. The other would be the therapy of good listening. The ability to receive into self the poetic theme or the harmony of poetry. The creation of poetry, naturally, is a more positive action. It is one in which culture in general, but reflection in particular, play their parts. We always observe that the person who is confused has difficulty in relaxation and has difficulty in separating his mind from the objects of confusion. Thus, the person who is psychologically burdened comes home from his work, brings his work home with him. His only way of getting his mind off of the task, off of the worry, off of the burden which it is carrying, is, to our normal way of thinking, a violent release of some kind. He must take a strong stand. He must substitute willingly and willfully another interest, perhaps no more orderly than the first. He simply throws his mind from one kind of confusion into another, thus feeling that he is gaining a certain release. One man said if he could throw his mind from an important confusion to a non-important confusion, he could relax. Well, maybe he could, but he will be tossing his intellect around indefinitely, and the wear and tear will be considerable. Actually, the transference of confusion constitutes one of our panaceas for life. We feel that our peace of mind must result from the complete occupation of our bodies and faculties. We are afraid of anything which actually suggests total relaxation. We are afraid we shall go to pieces. We are afraid we can no longer control ourselves if we once let down these barriers of will by which we dam up the currents and torrents within ourselves. We are simply afraid of our own psychic content. Therefore, we try to fatigue it by continual activity. To a measure, we are partly successful. But out of all of this, we also find that the wear and tear results in marked increase in nervous ailments and emotional pathology. Under such conditions, the importance of poetry as a creating media may be regarded with some interest. Have you ever noticed that even in arts and crafts, skilled artisans have a tendency to fall into rhythms? The man driving nails, if he is an expert carpenter, will gradually develop a rhythm. People running machines develop rhythms based upon the machines. And one of the problems that confronted music therapy was the danger of a therapeutic or a music rhythm that would vary from the rhythm of heavy industrial equipment. In other words, if a man is working with a certain type of die pressing machine, this machine has a tempo or speed of its own. If the individual's consciousness gets into a different type of rhythm, he is apt to have a dangerous or fatal accident. Thus, we have this point that machines have rhythms. And when the machine rhythm breaks, we are keenly aware of it, as a good automotive mechanic who can detect immediately from the rhythm of the motor that which is likely to be wrong with it. Thus, there are rhythms innate in things. There are rhythms which also mean continued function. There are rhythms in the individual which also relate to continued functioning on one or other level of existence. In our particular concern, therefore, we should analyze, if we can, the rhythm of man himself in relationship to all things with which he comes in contact. Nature itself is the source, of course, of rhythm symbols. The motion of animals, when slowed down by a modern camera, becomes a very clear evidence of a total grace of movement, a magnificent orderliness. The rhythms of tides, the motions of the heavens, all of these rhythms have affected man since the beginning of his experience. He has therefore followed a concept that to move with life is to ensure the function of life. To break rhythm with life is to endanger one's own survival. One of the commonest rhythms that we know of in life is the rhythmic alternation of activity and repose. Activity and repose also exists in music, in poetry, in art, and in practically all aesthetic media. Rhythm and repose we have to alternate in order to survive. This is so basic that very few persons question it. Yet at the same time, our tendency is to ignore the fact which is revealed through this alternation. Namely, that everywhere in nature we have a movement from action to repose, and a movement from repose to action. By repose, we mean, particularly in Taoism, the complete resting of the being. We have now come to the attitude that the only kind of repose that we can accept or understand is that which lies out of our control, for the most part, and that is sleep. We suspect that in sleep we relax almost totally, unless some agitation disturbs our interior rest. But theoretically, at least, man instinctively reacts to sleep and relaxes. Whereas in his waking state, he is never able to attain this degree of detachment. One of the reasons, of course, why sleep brings this detachment is because it suspends temporarily the mental and emotional focuses of the consciousness. But in a complete state of rest or relaxation, man becomes receptive. Whereas in his condition of activity, he is objective. Therefore, in his life, there is a continual alternation between objectivity and receptivity, between aggressive action and receptive action, not receptivity alone, inasmuch as receptivity is also an action of consciousness. Thus, the polarities do not represent action and inertia, but rather two polarized motions, one a flowing out from consciousness and the other a flowing back toward consciousness. In poetry, this again is preserved in the patterns of meters and in the creation of alternately or patterned emphasis and lack of emphasis. These situations refer again back to the life of the person very intimately. For every action that man performs, which is aggressive, outmoving, and affecting environment or his own exterior standing, there must be a parallel or accompanying reaction. On the level of our conduct, we incline to consider this as the law of karma, because the quality of the action, in most instances, causes the reaction to be unpleasant. Therefore, activity results in fatigue, which we to a measure object to. Or a certain particular kind of stress leads to a reaction of a stressful kind. And we are continually plagued by the reaction of action itself.